It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to the Untold Story podcast, everyone. I'm Martha McCallum. It's great to have you with us today. There is so much going on around the world and here at home with regard to foreign policy. And I'm really glad to be joined today by Roger Zackheim, who you may have seen on the panel with me on Fox News Sunday when I was in for Shannon on last Sunday morning. But Roger is the Ronald Reagan Institute director and a former general counsel on the House Armed Services Committee. He is a commissioner on the National Defense Strategy Commission. So, Roger, welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be back with you and enjoy the conversation on Sunday, and happy to continue the conversation.
So I always like to start this podcast. It's called The Untold Story, and I like people to get a sense of who you are and where you're coming from. So, Roger, for those who aren't familiar with your background, you know, where were you born? Why did you get into studying foreign policy? Give us a sense of your frame of reference.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm a Beltway kid. My father served in the Reagan administration, so they're a creature of the swamp or a creature of the Capitol, depending on your perspective. Always been interested in national security and foreign policy, and I escaped working for a high-paid law firm in my third year of law school by getting an offer to work on the House Armed Services Committee, which, as you know, is a committee that oversees the Pentagon, and did that for a number of years during the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan war, and have stayed focused working on national security and defense issues since.
Well, that's great. You know, I'm sorry that you escaped the big bucks at the law firm, but we're glad that you have been serving in such interesting and useful capacities in the Beltway. So thank you very much for joining me again. So, you know, one of the things that I'm struck by today as we start our conversation, and I know you're just back from Ukraine, and I absolutely want to talk to you about that, but I think all of these are they all kind of piece together in one way or another. But I was very struck by this video that I was watching earlier of this young man, an activist in Dearborn, Michigan, who is shouting death to America. He says he's quoting Malcolm X, saying that we live in the rottenest country in the world. And then he brings up a little boy who yells, you know, free, free Palestine from the river to the sea. Palestine will be free, which sounds like a nice little poem. But as everyone now well knows, it means the elimination of Israel, which is between that territory and the sea. What goes through your mind as someone who's worked on these issues for so long when you see someone talking like that at an American microphone?
It's sad. It reveals a fundamental misunderstanding of America and reflects a community that is lost in hatred. That's not what America's about. America is fundamentally about freedom, dignity, individual, and it's the greatest project in human history. And while everyone's entitled to their free speech, they're not entitled to their own facts here. And it needs to be countered. It needs to be countered with speech. Unfortunately, we've seen since October 7th, unbelievable hatred that's been unleashed, violently anti-Israel, anti-Semitic behavior. And, you know, there's always people who are anti-Semites. The problem is that it's been allowed to enter our public square in such a fundamentally different way than we had previously. And it needs to be countered from the White House, from the Congress. And Americans, of course, look at this and they want nothing to do with it. This is a marginal element that's having an outsized influence and voice.
Well, we're waiting right now to hear from the White House press office in their daily briefing. But I'm trying to figure out what they're going to say about this. And as you just pointed out, we do protect speech in this country, but we don't have to just let it lie and not respond to it or react to it. That is also free speech. And the White House has just reissued a $10 billion sanctions waiver for Tehran, unlocking a lot of frozen funds. So what would you expect to hear, or what would you want to hear from the president of the United States in reaction to this, if it's necessary?
The president needs to speak clearly into who our friends are and who our foes are, who are the allies here and who are the adversaries. And we talked about this on Sunday. Israel is our ally. The adversary is Hamas. And what's been lost over the past few weeks is there's been far more critique and holding Israel to account for its conduct in defending its own sovereign territory and its citizens than there has been any critique and pursuit of a terrorist organization, Hamas, and making it clear to Americans that we are on the side of Israel. When the president fails to do that, it really invites the sort of rhetoric you're hearing from Dearborn. So this is failed leadership. It needs to be corrected. And every time the president of the United States gets up at that rostrum in the White House or any place else, he has an opportunity to correct that. He's failed to do so. Listen, when he talks about the critique of Israel's operations and saying that he's considering a change of policy, all that does is provide aid and comfort to Hamas. And I'm glad you raised Iran as well, Martha, because what has not happened throughout this entire conflict since October 7th is the administration connecting the dots, the common sense dots, between what happened October 7th and Tehran. Tehran has given full support to Hamas. They give cover to Hamas. They fund Hamas. And the United States has not held Tehran to account for that support.
No, in fact, as I just mentioned, we just reissued $10 billion in sanctions waiver for Tehran. So we have helped to open up the spigots. And I know they say that it's all going to humanitarian aid. But I think just, you know, history tells us that money is fungible and it does seem to find its way to the water level to support these terrorists. But I want to ask you about this reaction also from the White House to the killing of two Iranian generals who were in Syria. And at that meeting, there were seven generals from Iran. So, A, what do you think they were doing in Syria? And B, why do you think the White House said, you know, we had nothing to do with that, nothing to do with that, despite the fact that, you know, these same generals are behind attacks that are aimed at Americans and American interests?
Well, these are IRGC generals who are planning attacks on U.S. forces. They've no doubt been responsible for attacks and the death of U.S. forces in Iraq, in Syria. The fact that Israel had to be the one to take him out reflects this administration's failed policy vis-a-vis Iran. The fact is, Israel did the U.S. a favor by carrying out that strike. And the notion that somehow this is sovereign territory and we have to respect a consulate or embassy that belongs to Iran is an utter joke. If there's ever the shining example of a country that has demonstrated that it does not respect kind of the diplomatic rules as it relates to embassies and consulates, it's Iran. So, again, it reflects this administration's really confusing policy vis-a-vis Iran. It's trying to somehow separate Iran from everything else that's going on in the Middle East. And what it does is it invites Iran to continue the funding and support of its proxies that are wreaking havoc on our ally Israel, our interests in the Red Sea, and U.S. forces, as you point out, in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine. I mean, the other choice is for the White House to say nothing and leave it ambiguous, you know, maybe we, you know, whether or not we had any involvement or whether or not we make any judgment on this, these two generals are gone. I'm not sure why we needed to step in and say, oh, we had nothing to do with that, given all of that.
Well, whatever the U.S. involvement was or was not, I think there's two points here. One, look at the situation where Israel feels it needs to act because the U.S. is not acting. Mm-hmm. The vacuum is left here. And if Israel doesn't act, it's going to harm our interests. That's where the Biden administration has left it. The second piece is what is the administration's reaction to it? And what they should be saying is, thanks to Israel for carrying out this strike and making sure that those actors, the IRGC and those they're planning with, are not going to threaten our forces and our interests in the region. You're not going to hear that, but that's what they should say.
So we saw this call for a ceasefire from President Biden in his conversation with Bibi Netanyahu last week. Then we saw a massive withdrawal of IDF forces from Gaza, leaving one battalion behind. They said that they are regrouping, that they might need to move forces to the north, where Hezbollah is, to the north of Israel. Bibi Netanyahu said today, the prime minister, we will continue to eliminate Hamas battalions. No force in the world can stop us. Your reaction?
It's consistent where Prime Minister Netanyahu has been, and equally important, that's where the people of Israel are. They don't have a choice here. They need to defeat Hamas. I view this as a tactical shift, but the strategy remains in place. They're going to have to go into Rafah. That's what the military strategists say. That's where the people feel that Netanyahu needs to go. Whether they have some sort of temporary ceasefire where hostages are released, that may be the interim step. Certainly, there's a lot of interest in Israel to see that. We need these hostages to be released. And this might be a pathway there. You're right to raise tensions in the north. There remains to be nearly 100,000 Israelis that are stranded. They cannot return to their homes in north of Israel because of the threat posed by Hezbollah and the rockets. Those forces need to be moved north of the Litani River. So there's a lot that Israel has to contend with. But the ultimatums here need to stop being ultimatums for Israel. They need to be ultimatums directed at Hamas. They are the organization that are holding five U.S. citizens and all the rest of the hostages. And they're the terrorist organization that's responsible for over 30 American deaths. It seems to be lost in the conversation, Martha, in Washington and what you see out of the Congress, whether it be liberal Democrats in the House of Representatives or some of the voices coming out of the Senate, too.
No, it's incredible to me that we never talk about the 30 Americans who were slaughtered on October 7th, who were part of the horrific activity that we saw. And also, as you point out, that there are five American hostages who are still being held. We've had some of the parents of the Hirsch parents were on Fox and Friends. Your heart just breaks. You know, their son was at the music festival, was basically corralled into a bomb shelter. There was a grenade thrown in. He lost half his arm. Then they had to witness him being put onto the back of a pickup truck. They've been through hell for 6 months, wondering every day if their son is dead or alive. And it strikes me that this negotiation, I'm not sure why we don't hear, well, let's start with returning every single one of these hostages, and then maybe you'll get a ceasefire.
Well, and it's certainly not helpful the way they're approaching it right now, where the U.S. somehow tries to assert itself like some mediator as opposed to placing demands. We are the superpower. This is some two-bit terrorist organization that we're treating as an equal, and it needs to stop. And whether it's Hirsch Goldberg Polin or the rest of the hostages, every time that the kind of reflexive statement coming out of the administration is Netanyahu this, the IDF that, it actually is strengthening Hamas and making them less willing to release the hostages. So, you know, you have Hirsch's parents here. They're advocating as they should be for their son's release. And they made it clear, and I saw an exchange with the Secretary of State who acknowledged after a conversation with Rachel Goldberg that until Hirsch is released, there is no success for the United States. And we need to continue to hold the administration accountable for that. And the American people should demand it. You know, Martha, you talk to many Americans, certainly of an older generation, you say the number 444. They know that's the number of days U.S. hostages were held in Tehran. Mm-hmm. But you talk to Americans today, ask them about the number 187, the number of days Hirsch and other hostages have been held by Hamas in Gaza. They don't know that number. Every American should know the number of days our citizens have been held in brutal conditions in Gaza by Hamas.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
No, it's a great point. And Hirsch's parents had, John and Rachel had 187 on their jackets when they were speaking to our morning hosts. And we've spoken to them over the course of these 6 months a couple of times. And as I said, your heart just absolutely breaks for them. And we have to remember these hostages. And we all remember the days ticking by when the hostages were held in Iran, as you say. It was every single night on the news. I remember as a kid, you know, my parents would talk about, you know, how long they've been held and how excruciating it is to have these Americans who are, you know, being held captive by Iran. And it was just on everyone's minds every day. And you're right, how quickly this seems to have dissipated. It's very sad. I want to ask you about your trip to Ukraine. And it's another thing that was so in front of everyone's minds when this war began. And We watched people huddled in the basements. We watched President Zelensky as he had to be very furtive in his movements. Everyone thought that, you know, he could be killed any moment by Putin's forces, this brave, you know, young Ukrainian leader. And they have fought every step of the way to get the munitions and weapons that they feel they need to hold off Russia. You were just there. Tell us where you think this stands.
Well, it's a tenuous moment. And you're right to point out how tenuous it was in February of 2022. In some ways, we are approaching the return to that moment, Martha. And here's what's happening. As you know well, and you report on, the U.S. is dithering. You know, the Congress is trying to decide whether or not they're going to fund more security assistance to Ukraine, which, as we know, means that we're going to take U.S. stocks and give them to Ukraine and then pay kind of U.S. defense weapons manufacturers to build new ones for the United States. And as we dither and discuss that, what I saw on the ground in Kyiv is they're not waiting around. They're continuing to engage in this conflict. Now, along the line of contact that is on the front in the eastern part of Ukraine, they're having trouble. Vladimir Putin absolutely knows that they lack air defenses. They're running low on munitions. And as a result, he's double downing on the effort. And they're having trouble holding the line. And that's the downside. Ukraine has been remarkably successful in pushing out the Black Sea Navy, the Russian Black Sea Navy. About 30 of their vessels, the Ukrainians have sunk. And as a result, they've reopened a corridor so they can export their grain and agricultural products, which is clearly having a material impact on Ukraine's economy. But in the absence of getting this aid through, it's probably a matter of months before Putin's going to see his advances becoming more significant and then threatening Kyiv once again. I mean, it is really tenuous, potentially perilous, and it makes the urgency of the situation, palpable when you visit Kyiv.
I'd like to get your opinion on NATO membership for Ukraine, because Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the other day that that will happen. Now, a number of presidents, American presidents, have not been in favor of that happening because of the corruption over the years in the Ukraine government and the uncertainty about whether or not the United States wanted to commit to use American troops if Ukraine was ever threatened. How do you view that, and whether or not that is something that we should be committing to, as this administration appears to be doing?
Events have really changed the answer to this question. Where I understand the view of previous presidents as to whether it was the right time to give Ukraine an opportunity to join NATO, events really now dictate that Ukraine not only should in the future become a member of NATO, but we should invite Ukraine into NATO. And here's why. Vladimir Putin escalates not when we give Ukraine weapons that could be used in, you know, Russian territory. He escalates when he sees weakness. He escalates when the U.S. Congress dithers on supporting and providing Ukraine aid. So in the absence of making Ukraine a member of NATO, we're inviting more of this aggression. And it happens to be that Ukraine is now one of the best fighting forces in all of Europe. So it's a net improvement in terms of NATO members being able to fight and defend and have a military that can aid in the security of the alliance. So I think where we are in the spring of 2024, it's really not a hard question to answer. Ukraine should be a member of NATO. They will add to the alliance. And it makes no sense to kind of wait on it. We ought to provide them with that invitation at the NATO summit in Washington, D.C. this July.
Well, I just wonder how you think some Americans might feel about the question, would you want your son to go to Ukraine to fight against the Russians on the front lines?
Yeah, I mean, what you're referencing is, okay, well, what's the cost potentially by making Ukraine part of NATO and therefore Article 5 being binding? I think the way you have to look at it is that Vladimir Putin can be deterred by NATO. He's invaded, of course, Ukraine in February 2022, Crimea in 2014, and then Georgia before that in 2008. He has not invaded NATO because that is a line he does not want to cross. So I think the chances of the U.S. Being brought in to conflict in Europe is increased if Ukraine falls, if we don't support Ukraine, and we actually add to deterrence in Europe by making Ukraine a member of NATO. Now, that to me is where the facts lead and where the events have played out over the past 2 years of this conflict.
So you see it as an effective deterrent that needs to be enshrined.
Absolutely. And you look at what's happened over the past 2 years. You know, Putin is in a stalemate with Ukraine and potentially making some progress on the line of contact that we discussed. But he's lost in the Black Sea, and he's lost overall because of Putin's aggression against Ukraine. Finland and Sweden are now members of NATO. It is a stronger alliance, and I think it'll be stronger with Ukraine. It's that sort of thing where he probes and he finds steel that he stops advancing. I think that's what would happen if we invite Ukraine to become a member of NATO.
Do you think that that would happen under President Trump if he wins election?
I don't know. You know, President Trump, has made famous that he would want to end this conflict in 24 hours. He hasn't said much for Ukraine, but he hasn't said much against Ukraine. And I expect that President Trump is kind of keeping his cards close. So I know this. President Trump has been outspoken for NATO members that don't commit 2% of their GDP to defense. Very clear that Ukraine as a committed fighting force that invests in its own defense. That's the sort of thing that I know President Trump wants out of all NATO allies, and Ukraine would excel in that regard.
What do you think about people who look at our southern border and say, look, I'm sympathetic to what's going on in Israel and Ukraine, but our border is overrun. Our cities are buckling under the weight of the increase in migrants flooding into these cities, and that's my priority. And I don't really want my tax dollars going to either one of these things right now until I know that the integrity of our own borders are secure.
Now, the border is without a question a huge national security challenge. But we're a great nation, Martha. It really comes back to our conversation about, you know, the haters in Dearborn, right? At the end of the day, we're a great nation that can do more than one thing. When it comes to the border, it requires leadership. President Biden is not been that leader. And as a result, we see this effective open border, which is absolutely creating all the security issues that you and others are reporting on. But that doesn't mean that we can't do other things. And effectively, Ukraine has depleted Russia's forces for pennies on the dollars if we'd have to do it ourselves. I mean, the Biden national defense strategy, the Trump national defense strategy names Russia as one of two major threats we face right after China. So we have an opportunity to have somebody else effectively do our bidding for us. We should embrace that. We should support freedom. And we should be able to secure our border. And I'm not one of those people, perhaps it's where I work, that's driving this, that think that America is some sort of small regional power that can only do one thing at a time. We're able to do great things, and we certainly should be able to secure our border and help the Ukrainians defend themselves and help Israel defeat Hamas. In fact, we need great partners and allies, and Ukraine and Israel will do that.
What do you think Ronald Reagan would say about our border?
Well, Ronald Reagan was somebody who embraced immigration. He knew that the shining city on the hill involved Americans of all kinds coming in, but he wanted them to come through the front door lawfully. He was the last president to actually have an immigration bill go through the Congress. At the same time, it was maximum liberty consistent with law and order. And that is clear in President Reagan's record. That's his legacy. And we need law and order when it comes to the border, too.
But what do you think he would say, you know, looking at Eagle Pass and looking at places where people are literally just running up to the fences, running up to the wall, pushing over National Guardsmen? What would he have done in that situation?
You know, I think so much of this is about leadership. I mentioned that a moment ago. He would have talked to the American people and talked to the world about how you get into this country, how you become American. He always talked about how you look anywhere across the world in direction and traffic flows of human migration. They always wanted to come to the land of the free. But he would have made very clear what would be acceptable way to enter the country and what would not. And we haven't had that. We haven't had that during the Biden administration. It would require strict border enforcement, which is lacking. And I think what that does is that it sends a message to everybody in our hemisphere, and then increasingly, as you've reported, from outside our hemisphere, that you're not going to get through the back door. the debate on whether or not we need more funding, another law passed. President Trump, of course, said he didn't want the Lankford bill to go through. Fine. There's so much that can happen under current law that's not happening because we lack a president who's seeking to enforce that. And, you know, that's obviously a huge weakness for the Biden administration, President Biden going into this election.
Roger, thank you very much. Great to have you with us today.
This is awesome. Appreciate the time.
Thank you very much. Roger Zakheim, the Ronald Reagan Institute Director, former General Counsel on House Armed Services, and the Commissioner on the National Defense Strategy Commission. Roger, hope to see you again soon. Thanks, Sue.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on The Untold Story. Hope we'll see you next time. Have a great day. I'm Martha McCallum. You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with the Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.